Greetings and welcome to Experiencing the Word, a Bible study ministry of Atonement Lutheran Church in Fargo, North Dakota. My name is Paul Cross, and I will be your guide through the Bible as we seek to understand God's plan for our lives and to learn life lessons from the pages of Scripture. In this season of study, we will focus our attention on Genesis, the first book of the Bible, the book of beginnings. If you would like to attend one of our studies, we meet at Atonement Lutheran, located at 4601 South University Drive here in Fargo. We meet on Wednesday nights at 6:30. But for now, join us in this recording of a live session of Experiencing the Word. For being here. Tonight, we're going to be focusing on a new chapter of Genesis. I call it Isaac, Jacob, and Esau, and the women who loved them. And really, it's really more about the women who loved them than it is about Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. It truly is about that. We're going to be looking a lot about some exceedingly strong women, some women that really carry themselves very well and equip themselves very well. Again, I can't get my understand why people tend to think that the Bible casts women in such a bad light. I don't know where this keeps coming from, but it keeps popping up. I think maybe certain elements in the church might cast women in a bad light, but I don't think the Bible does. So we're gonna see tonight for sure, because tonight we're gonna deal with my favorite Famali type in the Famali types. Female types, Famalis. Well, if they wanted it spelled female, they would have spelled it F-E-M-A-I-L. So, instead of Famali. Anyway, someone like to pray? I'll pray for us. We'll shake off the Father. Thank you so much for tonight. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and to be here tonight in your Word. Lord, bless all those who have gathered here tonight, and in a special way. And encourage them by this study, for we ask it in Jesus' name, and all God's saints said, amen. One quick thing, my sinuses can't take it anymore, so you're going to have to take it. There are some Easter lilies out in the narthex area that I want G-O-N-E gone, because my sinuses just can't take Easter lilies. I'm allergic to Easter lilies and Christmas trees, seriously. Seriously. Now, what kind of pastor is that that's allergic to Easter lilies and Christmas? It's not so much the Christmas trees. I've had a good doctor. What happens is this, is you bring a live Christmas tree or cut Christmas tree into a room. It's been sitting someplace frozen, and what happens is it starts to warm up, and it takes a certain amount of time for the mold that's on it to germinate its spores, or whatever mold does. I don't know if mold germinates or not. But it was. My wife swore that I hated Christmas, because every Christmas I would get a massive sinus infection, and we could never figure out why it was. We got rid of fresh-cut Christmas trees, and the sinus infections went away, because it was not the pine that I was allergic to, it was the mold spores, which would sort of start hatching right about Christmas time after everything warmed up. So there you go. Same deal. So it's that. Well, let's turn in our sheets. Just to let you know, we're going to be starting at Genesis chapter 24. And we're going to try something new, because there are people who actually listen to this. I mean, other than you, people that listen to this recorded. Maybe some of you are the ones that have been listening to it recorded. I don't know that. But there are people who do, and getting the questions and getting the Bible verses read at one time is a challenge. And so we're going to try something new. I can be taught. I can try, old dog, new tricks, and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, but tonight, get your notes out. And as I said, we're going to be looking at, and again, typically the Bible is looked at in most cultural terms and in church terms as the patriarchs.
Well, actually, the matriarchs, and particularly the one we're going to be looking at tonight, and a couple others, play a significant role in the telling of the story. And as we found out, just as a little bit of a refresher, you will recall that the story of Abraham, which we finished up before Lent, the story of Abraham is every bit the story of Sarah as it is Abraham. As a matter of fact, you'll recall that there was that opening little chiasm. Remember our friend, the chiasm, that little literary device that helps us understand what the most important point is? And that Sarah's barrenness was the main point of the story. And that was the problem that needed to be addressed, and that God addressed it miraculously. So that's kind of a neat thing. So today we will be introduced to the fruit of God's miracle, and that is Isaac. Actually, we already met him earlier, because you will recall something that I told you about that is, I don't want to say it's unique to the Bible, but it's certainly present in the Bible, and that's what I call the law of biographical overlap. And what that means is this. That sounds sort of imposing and academic, but it's really not. What biographical overlap means is this. As you read through the stories in the Bible, people's biographies overlap. And it's very difficult for, not very difficult, it's difficult to tell when one story ends and the other begins. Right now, we're in one of those periods, because even though part of Isaac's story is part of Abraham's story. Now, there comes a point ultimately when Abraham dies and it's all Isaac's story. But very quickly, you'll see that Isaac's story will turn into his sons, plural, Jacob and Esau's story. And the same will be said of Jacob's son, Joseph. While Jacob is still alive, it will quickly become Joseph's story. And this goes, the Bible does this a lot. I mean, it goes on and on like this. And I think it's a kind of a neat thing, too, because what happens is this. It shows the generational nature of being a person of faith. That there are people in our lives who build us up in faith, who encourage us, and sow into our lives spiritually, and then we kind of put out on our own. And then we kind of have our day. We have our day. And then we have the opportunity to do the same, to sow into a new person's life or several people's lives. Our faith and the life that God has given us in the Word and in our experiences about being a Christian, which is kind of interesting. A lot of times people, they suffer in silence with their Christianity. And what I mean by that is that a lot of people think that, you know, nobody is going through the same trials of faith that I'm going through. They think that this is something that it's only, that's unique to me. And yet, when we share our stories with others, who, and we do so in a relationship of trust and Christian encouragement, we find out that there are others who have that same sort of situation. And we, as Paul writes in Galatians chapter 6, we bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. And that's such a neat thing. And that's what the Bible not only teaches that, the Bible models that. And this biographical overlap is a modeling of that, because you see this happening. You're going to hear a lot about these banners in the next 7 weeks. And what I'm talking about here primarily is this one right here, active discipleship. Discipleship is done in a community. It is not done in a vacuum. Discipleship can't be done in a vacuum. It's not a solitary activity. Discipleship is a community activity. It is a relational activity. And so it is we see these relationships between generations. It's kind of one of the neat things about this church. I like this church a lot. But one of the things I like about this church a lot is that it is truly multi-generational church. very unusual for Lutheran churches. Lutheran churches are generally not multi-generational. But as far as that goes, this is a pretty multi-generational church. Pretty impressed by that. Pretty neat. So, well, let's talk about who it is. So we're blending Abraham's life into Isaac. So Isaac has about 10, I would say 10 episodes in his life that we can identify. The first that we see is the promise of an heir, that Isaac is a promised heir. That starts very early on. God promises Abraham that he and Sarah are going to have a son, and he's going to be the son of promise. It's not one that Abraham has to go out and manufacture with the hoochie girl Hagar, who's all hot and all that sort of stuff, and you know she's all that. But no, it's with his intended wife, Sarah, because that's where the promise is going to be. And that's an important part, that God's word provides an indication of God's faithfulness. That's what we will learn in that. God's word provides an indication of his faithfulness. The second one is Isaac's birth. In the face of such a miracle, the promised birth of Isaac, Abraham obeys God in naming the boy Isaac, which of course is a testimony to the miracle-working power of God. Because his name means laughter, exactly. Because this was such a great joke. And everybody who heard it thought it was a great joke. But, you know, the joke is on everybody who heard it who laughed. Because it means he laughs and God is the one that gets the last laugh. And so the name Isaac means laughter or he laughs. And so that is a very important episode in this. In naming him, it's an act to the testimony of God's covenant in Abraham to all future generations. Furthermore, he gave the boy the clippity-clip. And the clippity-clip, of course, is the circumcision, and that is a sign of that covenant for all future generations within that God had done something there. Okay? So there you go. That's the second one. The third episode is the rival son. The single greatest threat to the promise of this son is that there was a rival son. And that rival son, of course, is Ishmael, and has caused all sorts of problems subsequent. I think we can all agree that there have been some issues between those who are followers of the Isaac line and those who are followers of the Ishmael line. Those folks have had problems for quite some time and continue to do so to this day. But the rival son, and that is indicative of doing things on our own strength. When we think that we get a really great idea. If we get a really great idea, do you know what the first thing we should do is? Not do it until we've prayed about it. Sometimes we think we get the greatest ideas that they're out there, but we should wait and ask God, God, is this really a good idea? Is this as good an idea as I think it is? Now, admittedly, it was Sarah's idea, but Abraham certainly did not say, you know, honey, I think we should first pray about this. No, I think he said, well, you know, when do we get this done? We have that issue. So I think that's a good example of our need to pray about such things. Then the next episode in Isaac's life is one of the more famous ones. This is when he is a young boy or teenager or something like that. He's not as young as the pictures make him out to be. And we're going up off to Mount Moriah, which is where Jerusalem is now today. And we're going off there and we're going to sacrifice this kid because God says we're going to sacrifice him. And so is that really what happens? No, that's not really what happens. God says, no, we don't need to do this. It demonstrates not only Abraham's obedience to God, but it also demonstrates Isaac's submission to his father. So that's a pretty important thing. The next story that we encounter has to do with the birth, the marriage of Isaac, which takes place at a very strange sort of time. It takes place after Isaac's mother dies. You think she would have wanted to be there for the wedding. No, weddings were different in those sort of days, but nevertheless, that is what we're going to be. We're going to start with this particular episode, and we'll look at it a little bit more carefully. Then also later in this series, we're going to look at the birth of Isaac's and Rebekah's twin sons. That's an important thing. Then reconfirming the covenant, we'll look at that. Isaac's dealings with Abimelech, and then... Then things get very interesting. We have yet another biographical overlap here, and that is the blessing and cursing of Isaac and Rebekah's two children. That will be a rather interesting story. It'll be a while before we get to that, but just to let you know that that is on the horizon. And then last but not least, the death of Isaac. So those are the main units or stories in the narrative of Isaac's life. I will say this, that of all the patriarchs, of all the people in the book of Genesis, Isaac has to be the flattest character from a literary perspective. He's downright boring. He really is. Passive. Mercifully, his wife is anything but boring. She is quite the lady. I really enjoy Rebekah tremendously. She's one of my favorite people in not just the book of Genesis, but the whole Bible. I think that Rebekah is perhaps the single most interesting person, female, to study in the Bible. I just love studying her. It's great. So anyway, we'll have a good time with that. Some parallels between Abraham and Isaac. I think it's important for us to kind of look at those real quick. The first parallel between Abraham and Isaac is this, that they're the barrenness of the matriarch. For Sarah, it was a very long time. For Rebekah, it was 20 years. That's a long time, friends. We have brothers that are at odds with each other. In the case of Abraham's sons, Isaac and Ishmael are half-brothers, but nevertheless brothers at odds with each other. In the case of Isaac, they are twins. The younger offspring is to be the one who is to be blessed. That's a parallel as well. Isaac was the younger offspring compared to Ishmael, and Jacob is the younger offspring there. The older son is an expert with a bow. That's just kind of an interesting and curious thing. I don't know that it says much, but it is true. Also, riches. They're both rich. Then she's my sister. That will come up again, that story. And then the trouble with Wells, and I don't mean the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. You don't have a lot of Wells churches around here. I want you to know that. You really don't. You get to hear the preliminaries. For the sermon series about advancing God's kingdom, I'm going to talk about why is there a church on the corner, between the Vault Company and the golf course on South University Drive. Do you know how many Lutheran churches are 15 miles or less from our doorstep? Do you have any idea? 50. Actually, it's 51. And if you encounter, and so basically, you could go to a different Lutheran service every day, every week of the year, and have 2 weeks for vacation. Because you would need a vacation after that. But of those, there's only one Wells. Or are there two? There might be two. Yeah, there's one in West Fargo. That's right. Yeah, there's one in West Fargo. Is there one in Moorhead? Maybe there might be one in Moorhead. But there are 38 ELCA churches, just to give you some idea. This is a predominantly ELCA area. You go to New Ulm, Minnesota, that would be a little bit different statistic, but that's because all those Germans are down there. So anyway. 15 miles. 15 miles. I can say with certainty that the Fargo-Moorhead area is a place where Lutherans are dense. Ah! There are a lot of them there. Did you think I meant something else?
Ask him the question if he still works here.
Did you think I meant something else? Anyway, I think it's hilarious. Any case, however, it's not the place where they're most dense. They're simply dense here. They're most dense in the Twin Cities. I did the same quick study of a zip code kind of central to the Twin Cities, and it was just an astronomical number of Lutheran churches that within 15 miles of that. So anyway, be that as it may, why was I talking about that? Trouble with wells, that was it, yes. The trouble with wells. And that was a pretty good joke, too. If you happen to be of the Lutheran persuasion, you know. Okay, let's get to it. All right, so we're going to turn in our Bibles to chapter 24 of the book of Genesis. And Keith, would you mind beginning to read? I will interrupt you at the appropriate times, but I will not let you know what they are. So, okay.
Now Abraham was old,
mm-hmm.
well advanced in years. And the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh."
I'm going to stop there. There's just some things you don't want to know, but you need to know. And when I tell you this, you're going to say, "You're right, I didn't want to know that." But in making a promise of something that's important, it was common, from what I understand, in the culture of that time, was to swear by your posterity, not your posterior, what are located between a man's thighs are his boy parts. Yes, this sounds pretty awful, but that's exactly what's going on, is that he is, now this can be looked at one of two ways, either swearing by the covenant of his circumcision or swearing by the seed of his testicles. I'm not making this up. I'm not saying this to be disgusting or anything else. It's a curious sort of thing. We can be grateful that we don't make such covenants nowadays, but you might wonder when you see that, that's what's going on there. But it's really important. It shows the absolute critical nature of what comes next. This is also going to happen later on in the book of Genesis with another patriarch. It has to do with Joseph and Jacob. But the reason why I bring this up, it shows the gravity of the story that comes next. Now, speaking of gravity, Jarl has come in to tell us of something to break the gravity, because we were just telling them what that was, because I'm not going any further. So read on, Keith. We have something about thighs.
Yeah.
Okay.
"Put your hand under my thigh."
There you go.
"That I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country, to my kindred, and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came?" Abraham said to him, "See to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send an angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if a woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there."
Mm-hmm.
So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master,
apparently it
and
works.
Swore to him concerning this matter.
Okay. All right.
Then the servant...
Now we'll stop there.
Okay.
So what we have going on here is the changing of the chapter between Abraham and Isaac. Sarah is now dead, and she is in the grave. We saw that in chapter 23 before we left. But he is the promised heir. His birth we've already talked about. The two threats we've already talked about in his life. Now we're going to introduce the blessing. Now, she actually already got introduced a little bit earlier, which is kind of funny. I'm going to have to back us up a little bit here. Chapter 22, and beginning with the 20th verse. Now, I won't make anybody suffer through saying these names out loud, but I'll do it myself. Now, chapter 22, verse 20 says, "Now, after these things, it was told Abraham, 'Behold, Milcah has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother.'" I triple dog dare you to name any of your children Uz and Buzz, and only use one Z for Buzz. "And his brother Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazo, who is, of course, Harpo's brother, Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel." Now, here's an interesting thing. Anytime you see something in parentheses, which, of course, were not there in the original Hebrew, but when you see them there, there's a parenthetic comment that's being made, and you might want to put up your list. Now, Bethel was fathered who? Rebecca. Holy cats. What's she doing there? "These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. Moreover, his porcupine, whose name was..." His concubine, whose name was Roima, bore Taba, Gaham, Tahash, and Ma'ak, something or other. Oh, well. 12 sons and one daughter. Sound familiar? 12 sons and one daughter. So we've got 12 sons and one daughter showing up here. But why is this here? It's here to introduce Rebecca. Because later in the story, well, now we're there, we're going to meet Rebecca and her family and her father, Bethuel. Bethuel has to be the only person who is a flatter character than Isaac. His son, however, Laban, is not a flat character by any stretch of the imagination. So let's go on a little bit further here. Hold on just a second here. So now with the marriage of Isaac, we have a couple things that are going on here. The point of the story is this. We've read the point of the story. Whatever you do, don't you beware marrying no Canaanite or Hittite women. Don't be doing that, because they don't think the way we do, they don't act the way we do, and they don't worship the God that we worship. The Canaanite she folk are not that way. Now, what's interesting is Abraham has pretty good relations with the Hittites and the Canaanites, but not good enough as to have his son marry one, which will become ironic as things open up, because this will become a problem for Esau. His grandson, Esau, will marry some Hittite women, which is what gets people all cranked up in the family. You know how things are when, you know, you marry the person that your parents tell you not to, right? I'm sure that didn't happen here at all. None of you have ever had to deal with that, have had you, correct? I'm just saying, I'm not trying to open any wounds. I'm just trying to point something out to you. The Bible has the ring of truth about it, because this sort of stuff happens all the time, right? It happens all the time. Our kids do wacky things. Geez, I wonder why. Because when you're corn, you plant corn, and you know what you reap? You reap corn. So guess what? We're wacky. We've never done anything that our parents didn't want, did we? Oh, well, there you go. So in any case, we have that thing going on there. Then Judah also. Judah, you know, why does Judah get such a good rap? We're going to find out that Judah is an absolute bona fide 24-carat rat. But everybody sings songs, you know, Lion of Judah on the throne. You know, all this, you know, Judah this and Judah that. And why does Judah get such good billing? He is a total rat. He's a worse rat than David is a rat. We'll find this out. You think, how can you say that? It's Judah for crying out loud. No, he's a rat. And did I mention that he was a rat? In any case, but he marries a Canaanite woman. Apparently, however, it's okay to marry Egyptian women for some reason. Because Abraham himself has Hagar, then Ishmael, he's got an Egyptian wife, and then Joseph has an Egyptian wife. So apparently it's okay to marry Egyptian women. As to why this is, that Canaanite women are bad and Egyptian women are good, is beyond me. Maybe there's some reason for it. If you find out, please let me know. But the case is this, is that Abraham does not, under any circumstances, want his son marrying any Hittite or Canaanite woman. They're pretty much the same thing interchangeably. All right? Now, I want to be clear about something here, though. I can say this with some degree of certainty. This is not a function of ethnicity, as some people have tried to make it. Because ethnically, these people are all Semitic people. There is example after example after example throughout the Bible where outsiders have looked at these various folks and said they can't tell the difference. As a matter of fact, Paul is confused for an Egyptian by the Romans. Why is that? Because they're not that different looking ethnically. So I want to be really clear that this isn't a reason to exclude people intermarrying ethnically. More than likely, it has to do with issues of something far more important. And that's a matter of faith. Because faith is a big, big issue. And when you marry somebody outside your faith, it can, not invariably, but it certainly can cause all manner of heartache and hard feelings. I mean, I'm not at liberty to give names and addresses. But I can tell you, in my life as a pastor, I have had to deal with this. And I'm sure people have. Again, sometimes it's okay, but other times, and you know, a mixed marriage is not a Swede marrying a Norwegian, by the way. Just kind of let you know that. Some people think it is, but I don't know. In any case, so that's one of the things that we have. But he is to marry his own tribe, clan. Get this, Abraham and Sarah, they are half siblings. We can all collectively go, ooh. Ishmael, Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah are first cousins once removed, by the way. Just kind of let you know that. They're first cousins once removed. And then Jacob and Leah are, and Rachel, Jacob and Leah and Jacob and Rachel, they're first cousins, and they're married to each other, in addition to being first cousins once removed. How's that? Now that's interrelated. But for some reason, I know, what are you thinking right now? What do you think of all that? Isn't that crazy stuff? I'm not making any of this up. All you got to do is just sort of connect the dots of these. Again, I've told you before, the genealogies are not unimportant. But the idea, what's important is we want people who have the same understanding of God. That's what we're looking for, okay? So there goes to some significant extent to do this. All right. Then there is the point of the story. Then there is the journey of the story. The journey, what he's going to do is he's going to send... did anybody bring your atlas with you? If you did, God bless you if you got your atlas. If you didn't, that's okay too. It's pretty early on. Wally. Oh, yes. It is on page 11, down there below, and there is the map, from Hebron, which is down at the bottom of, you see it down there, Hebron down the bottom? Take a look where it says Jerusalem, and you see the Dead Sea there, and then just go a little bit to the left of that, and then you see Hebron, and then all the way at the top, do you see where Haran is? See it there? That is a distance of 520. No, we're not in Canada, not kilometers. 520 miles. Okay, you're taking this trip of 520 miles on the back of a camel. We do know that they are using, the story even says that they are using camels as transportation. There are 10 camels that are involved. It even tells you the number. So people who know these things suggest that this would be a minimum of 21 days. That's a lot of time. That's a significant piece of. Then you got 21 days to come back. Plus, there's the expense that's involved in sending these camels out for 42 days. That's a big hunk of time. So just to kind of let you know, there's a lot of effort that goes on, particularly with this journey. What it says about the journey is this: it speaks to the effort and expense speak to the level of importance that Abraham places on this. Abraham's a wealthy guy, we know that, but Abraham's basically saying, this is important. I want you to swear by whatever it is that you're swearing by underneath there. I want you to do whatever it is you do, and I will pay the whole expenses, and I'm going to give you a truckload of stuff, you know, 10 camels worth of stuff. And he does put 10 camels. I mean, these aren't just 10 camels, you know, to rest one. No, they all got stuff on them because we want to impress the gal. We want the gal to think that, hey, we got some cash here. And so we want her to say yes. So then you have this. Then you've got the following characters, and we'll take a look at each character in a little bit in order. Number one, we have got Abraham's servant. We'll talk about him a little bit. Number two, we've got Rebecca. Number three, we have got Laban. Ooh, boy, run away, Laban. Abraham, Isaac, and then Bethuel and his wife. So we'll start reading on. Okay, read on there, Keith.
Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed.
10 camels.
Taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master, and he arose and went to...
Not just the junky ones, you know.
And went to
Not the stuff you got at Dollar General.
He arose and he went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of evening, the time when women go to draw water.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink, and I will water your camels. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master.
You know, I don't know about this, and I can't say it worked for everybody, but I would think, you know, that if you're looking for a mate, you would want this servant praying for you. I mean, you would want that to happen, because guess what happens next? Read on.
Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, and the wife of Nahor,
there they are again.
Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden to whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please give me a little drink. Or a little water to drink from your jar. She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink.
Mm-hmm.
When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking.
Dang, man.
So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew water for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not.
Do you remember the Jerry Lee Lewis song, Little Queenie? It goes, meanwhile, I'm still thinking. I can just see the servant there saying, I'm thinking, I'm looking at this. Let's see. First of all, she's a very attractive young lady. She's very, very attractive young lady. Second of all, she's got all the right stuff with all the right stuff. you know, the lineage and all that sort of stuff. And then on top of that, I ask her for a drink. She gives me a drink. And on top of that, guess what? She waters my camels too. Meanwhile, I'm still thinking. There you go. All right. There you go. Read on.
When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, "Please tell me whose daughter you are."
Okay, just for your learning and information, in case, because I know some of you are wondering, just how much gold is this? This is approximately a smidgen over 4 ounces of gold. At today's gold rate, I checked it today, $4,500 worth of gold. Okay? So that's just the gold. That's not all the effort that went into making it, you know, into what it's supposed to be. So that's a fairly tidy little sum. Just sort of say, oh, and by the way, here you go. You like this? We've got more. So that's a fairly nice little gift. That will get a girl's attention, wouldn't you say? Don't you love this ad that some jeweler's running here in Fargo Moorhead? It shows a picture of a diamond and some scissors and a paper. And it says, "Rock always wins."
Yeah.
I love that.
That's clever.
Someone was clever in thinking when they put that one up. So anyway, we've got that going on. Keep going.
She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." She added, "We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night."
Mm-hmm.
The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman." Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things.
Her mother's household about these things. That's curious. Interesting. Well, I'm going to stop here and take a look at this servant here. Let's take a look at do a little bit of character study about the servant, because there's some things which are quite fascinating about him. First of all, he's not named, except to say that he's sort of the most senior tenured servant in Abraham's household. In that day, had Abraham not had an heir, this person would have been entitled to Abraham's inheritance legally. Now, Abraham has two heirs. Now he has Isaac, and he also has the spare Ishmael. So this guy doesn't have that anymore. We do know from another place that Abraham had a servant whose name was Eleazar of Damascus. So he probably was somebody that he picked up along the way as a slave and had served Abraham very well. But here's some things about this guy that I want to highlight, which are particularly of worthy of note. He is unbelievably loyal in his character of obedience to Abraham, his dedication to his appointed task. Number one, he is charged by his master with a task, so he does it. But the thing that I think is fascinating is the first thing he does is he seeks God's help in it. Isn't that the last thing that we do? You know, aren't we people that say, if all else fails, we'll pray? This is the first thing he does. This is the first thing that he does. And if we don't learn anything else tonight, this is the one thing that we should learn. That whatever task that we have been appointed to, the first thing we should do is to ask God's guidance in that task, particularly if we know it's something that God would have us do. If there's one takeaway, grab a hold of that particular one takeaway, because that is so rich and so great for us. And again, we don't know. Then after praying about it, then what does he do? He sits on his hands and just sort of doesn't do much about it. No, that's not what he does at all. He goes to the task. He picks it up. Pray as if it all depends upon God, and act as if it all depends upon you. You've heard that before. I'm not so keen on the last part as I am the first part. But nevertheless, he prays, and then he acts upon it. He goes out and gets it done, and he even says, "God, I really need to be clear about this," and there's nothing wrong with that. Then, after this all happens, when he sees that all the boxes are checked, and that's what he does. I mean, if you take a look at this, all the boxes are checked. There is no reason why anyone could have any objection to him bringing this girl back home if she's willing to come. So all the boxes are checked, and then he acknowledges God's hand in this. So it wasn't simply praying to God and say, God, but then stops and says, God, you're the one that did this. You brought this about. And he offers that acknowledgement. And that's another big takeaway, I think, from this, is that it's important for us to also acknowledge God's hand when we see God's hand at work in our lives and when we can give testimony to what God has done for us. It's so important for us to do that. It truly is. And again, this is from the Old Testament. This isn't, you know, the wrath and law and all that. This is cool stuff. This is really grace-oriented stuff. And I'm so fascinated by it. That's why I love this book so much, is because you see cool stuff like this in here. You see a guy like this. And then last but not least, he quickly carries out the task when he sees that God's hand is upon it. When he sees that this is of God, he wastes no time. He doesn't want to dally around. He doesn't want to dance around. He doesn't want to waste any time. He says, you know, the clock's ticking on old Abraham. The clock's ticking on old Abraham. I need to get this gal back as quickly as possible, which is what we're going to see right now. But we're going to meet some more fun people first. Read on.
Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban.
Okay, now stop right here. Just to let you know. Right about now, everything's innocent and fine. Just happens to say that he has a brother named Laban. Now, the name Laban means white in the Semitic languages, and so I have come to call him Whitey. You know, and Whitey's kind of a nickname, but Whitey's the kind of a nickname you give to somebody like Whitey Bugler, right? Wasn't he the guy? Wasn't that the criminal guy that did all the whacking of people and stuff like that? It's kind of one of those names of somebody that, you know, you really should watch out if you meet a guy named Whitey. I mean, that's just, as I said, you wonder how he got the name. I kind of refer to him that way because that's what his name means in Hebrew, is white. But there he is. Let me give you a little hint. You're going to run into him again. And when you do, you better have been a close observer of a person's character and personality, because it will come in handy. Read on. I'll just leave you hanging there and let you know that sooner or later, he's gonna be here in this episode, and he's going to be large and in charge in this episode. But sooner or later, he's going to show up again, and then we're going to have some real fun. Okay? Read on.
Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arm and heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, thus the man spoke to me. He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside?
You must have more.
For I have prepared the house and a place for the camels." So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him.
Mm-hmm.
Then food was set before them to eat. But he said, "I will not eat until I have said what I have to say."
Mm.
And he said, "Speak on." So he said, "I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old. To him he has given all that he has."
Mm-hmm.
"My master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I dwell.'"
Now see, my parents told me never to swear, but that's kind of new there.
"But you shall go to my father's house."
Put his arm in a chicken wing and said, "Swear."
"To my clan and take a wife for my son."
Ooh.
"I said to my master, 'Perhaps the woman will not follow me.' But then he said, 'The Lord before whom I have walked will send an angel with you and prosper your way.
Oh, my.
You shall take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. And if they will not give her to you, you will be free from my oath.
I just want to highlight again here. Notice the decidedly faith-oriented orientation of this story. That this is really about faith. Abraham saying, the Lord will put an angel before you. God's got his hand in this. I know it. And why does he know it? Because he's an old guy now, and he has seen the faithfulness of God. That's one of the neat things about the longer you walk with God, the more miles you have on the odometer, the more spiritual patina you have. I love the word patina. Any of you watch the Antiques Roadshow? One of my favorite. I learned two great words from the Antiques Roadshow. The first great word that I learned from the Antiques Roadshow is provenance, which has really provenance. You gotta get your little pinky up when you say it. And that means that you can trace the history of something. And boy, that will add to the value of something. But patina is the oxidization that's on an antique. And, you know, only someone who's inexperienced, I was going to say nitwit, but would refinish an antique because that takes off about 90% of the antique's value when you do that. Because it's the patina that puts value on it. And you know, when we get beat on spiritually in our lives, and we have to go through trials in our lives, and we have to trust God in our lives, and we get beat on spiritually, and we get that patina put on us, you know what? That's Mark. No, it's not. It's Seguin, Texas. Oh, well, not tonight. You know what it does? It puts value on your life. When you get that beat up, beat on, and Abraham got beat up and beat on spiritually, that's what it does. And Abraham can look back over his life and see God's angels. Well, he knows about God's angels. He laughed in their face. He's not laughing now. He's instructing his servant, don't worry, God will send angels. Boy, it was a tough lesson for him to learn when he had to have that encounter with the angels, because then there was that very tenuous bargaining that was going back and forth, and he knew that lives were at stake. But what's happened to Abraham in his old age is that he's far less impetuous and far more focusing on what God's capable of doing. And he knows God's capable. And that's how he speaks. Out of his heart, out of his experience, Abraham is speaking into his servant's life and saying, God is faithful, and that's what's going to happen. Hope you can see that, because that's kind of cool right here in this story. That's really one of the neat things about this particular story. There's also some fun stuff in it, too. Read on.
I came today to the spring and said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now you are prospering the way that I go, behold, I am standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes to draw water, to whom I shall say, please give me a little water from your jar to drink, and who will say to me, drink, and I will draw for your camels also. Let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son. Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with her water jar on her shoulder, and she went down to the spring and drew water.
Okay, we'll stop here for a second. Now, basically, he's simply repeating what's going on, going through it step by step, item upon line, line upon precept, showing all the boxes were checked. Everything was lined up. I've had that happen in my life, and it's kind of interesting. Coming here, the boxes were checked. I mean, do you think a person leaves Texas in the middle of January to come to Fargo? Do you think that? But no, all the boxes were checked. When I went to Seguin, all the boxes were checked. I mean, it's kind of neat when you see all the boxes checked and you can walk in that. And so that's what he's going to tell line upon line, precept upon precept, that, hey, all the boxes were checked. And that's how I knew God was at work. Okay, let's skip ahead to verse 50.
Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said...
Notice who's answering first. Mm-hmm. Now, does that strike you as a little odd?
Mm-hmm. Bethuel is her dad.
Correct.
And
now, Rhonda, you've met Sergeant Cross, haven't you? Do you think that he would let any of his sons speak for him or before him?
Probably not.
Tells us a little something about Bethuel and tells us an awful lot about Laban. Because who was it that went to meet him? It was Laban that met him. Something's amiss in this family. Something's not quite right here. Little hints here and there. Not big hints, but little things that you go, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay, read on.
The thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the earth before the Lord. And the servant brought out jewelry of silver and gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave to her brother and to her mother.
Your meter should be going off there. The brother gets a gift first and then the mother.
Costly ornaments.
And see, these are the little things. This is why I taught you the class last summer about the inductive method, because we have to be biblical bloodhounds and be looking at our surrounding instead of just going, I think I'll read the Bible today. I didn't get anything out of it. Well, guess not. You're not looking for anything there. There's all kinds of crazy. There are all kinds of clues all over the place saying something's amiss here. I don't know quite what it is, but sooner or later I'll find out what's amiss. Okay, read on.
And he and the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there.
Mm-hmm.
When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." Her brother and her mother said,
"Whoa! Mama's answering now. Where's Papa in all this?"
"Let the young woman remain with us a while, at least 10 days. After that she may go." But he said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." They said, "Let us call the young woman and ask her." And they called Rebekah and said to her,
Notice what's going on here. Read on.
"Will you go with this man?" She said, "I will go." So they sent away Rebekah and their sister.
Does it say anything about her saying, "I'd rather wait 10 days. Can I be with my mom for 10 days? I really miss my mom."
So they sent away Rebekah and their sister.
Didn't
and
you hear what I just
nurse.
Said? "I really miss my mom. Can't I stay a little longer?" She doesn't say that at all. What does she say? "I will go. Get me out of here now." Whoa. Yeah. Read on.
So they sent away Rebekah and their sister and her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "Our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, mm-hmm. and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate him."
Again, this right here should just drive you. This is, if you know anything about the ancient Near East, this right here is great. May you possess the enemy, your enemy's gate, the gate of your enemy. This is something that you would bestow upon your firstborn son or something along those lines. This is an incredible blessing that they're putting on her. It's an amazing blessing. So, okay, read on.
Then Rebekah and her young women arose and rode the camels and followed the man.
Mm-hmm.
Thus the servant took Rebekah and went his way. Now Isaac had returned from Beer Lahai Roya.
Yeah, that's it. That'll work.
And was dwelling in Negeb.
Out knocking down a couple Shiner box. Beer Lahai Roya.
And Isaac went out to mediate in the field toward evening.
Meditate,
I'm sorry.
No, he's not mediating anything.
Yeah, anyway.
I want you to get a picture of this guy. He's just sort of flounced, and he comes in. He's not really watching any. He's out meditating in the field, okay?
So right. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?"
Mm-hmm.
And the servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself.
Mm-hmm.
And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother.
That says something in itself, too. That just doesn't, that's wrong. But that's
and
okay.
Took Rebekah, and she became his wife,
mm-hmm.
and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death.
Okay. Wow. All kinds of stuff going on here. Let's find out some fun stuff now. Let's take a look at some of these people. As I said, we already took a look at the servant. We saw what a good guy he was and Now, what about Rebekah? Rebekah is great niece to Abraham. And unlike her future husband, Rebekah is anything but a shrinking violet. She is by far the most interesting female character in the book of Genesis, perhaps the entire Bible. Her most notable role will be in the famous episode where she conspires with her son Jacob to deceive her husband and wrest the blessings from Esau. Now, is that something a good mother does? My question is this. Where did she learn how to do that? Where did she learn something like that? Are you kind of catching on something? Are you getting the sense that there's some serious dysfunction in this family? Serious dysfunction. I mean, it's just hints. I mean, it doesn't. You don't spell out, it says, and here is this dysfunctional person, and he's dysfunctional. You know, we're not going through a clinical diagnosis, Billy Sue. We're not doing that right now. Something like that. I mean, pretty close. It's wacky. It really is. I mean, but it gets worse. I mean, the family dysfunction in this gets worse, and you haven't seen the worst yet. I gave you a little hint, but we'll wait. You'll have to wait. You'll have to wait to find out about that dysfunction. Anyway, because that's fun. She does the following. She has the watering jar, so she does that. There are gifts that get bestowed upon her, which seem like a lot, and then caused her brother Whitey to stand up and take note and say something about this character. That says something about him. And second, the more significant thing is that she is willing to get the heck out of there. She wants to go in a moment's notice and either shows her sensitivity or prompting to the Holy Spirit, or she has other reasons to leave home. It could be either one. It could be that she's a very sensitive person of the Holy Spirit, or she does have other reasons to leave home. Striking the blessing, she is blessed in the same way in which Abraham is. Abraham is blessed by saying, "May you possess the gate of your enemies." So that's that she is a mother of a multitude. Abraham is blessed to be a mother, maybe a father of a multitude. Her descendants are indeed blessed in that way, so you can see that that's a case. Also, her dad was rich. Daddy was very wealthy. Otherwise, wouldn't have all that women and stuff to go with it. Now, we come to her brother, Laban, or Whitey. Thus, the grandnephew of Abraham. And the appearance of Laban in this account is a prelude of things to come. And I do mean a prelude of things to come. A few clues indicate his character, which will become all too apparent as his dealings will come very much apparent in a future episode, which we won't name right now. Number one, he is not his father, but he acts like it. He acts like he's the man in charge. He greets the servant. He is the one to care for the camels. He, along with his father, make the decisions to send Rebekah off. He, with his mother, pleads to allow Rebekah to stay. He is the one that's listed in the table of Isaac, which is kind of curious. So we've got this character. Then we've got Abraham. Abraham sends his most trusted servant on one of the last and most important missions. Abraham's prayer for his servant indicates a great deal about his faith. We already talked about that. First, the servant refers to the Lord as his master. Second, he understands that the Lord is the one who grants his earnest request. Third, he acknowledges the Lord's faithfulness. Fourth, And what is fascinating is the servant is quite specific in the request. And fifth, the servant reiterates all of that. So this is about faith. This is a story about incredible faith. The business about promising, I already told you about that, so I won't go back to that again. Then Abraham has wised up. No longer is he jeopardizing the promise and the promised land. And here's the thing. Do you remember? Back a little bit, we have to refresh our memory. Abraham was promised three things: land, offspring, blessing, and he was perpetually putting those things in danger. He finally is wised up. He said, number one, the offspring needs to be perpetuated. Number two, that God is going to be the one implementing the blessing. I don't have to engineer anything. And if the woman won't come, the woman won't come. I'm not going to try to figure out my own way to get her to come or trick her to coming. It's up to the hand of God. And number three, whatever you do, don't take my son back there. Don't take the promise of the land and remove him from the land. So Abraham has wised up in his old age. It's kind of a neat little thing to see there, because those are the three things that God promised him, and those are the three things that he was incessantly botching and trying, and almost, you could almost see him like he was intentionally trying to mess up. So there you have that. Okay, so there you've got Abraham. Then you've got Isaac out meditating in the field. Rebecca is the source of comfort while his mother's death. Notable among Isaac and Patrick is that there's no mention. This is indeed notable. Isaac is unique among the patriarchs, and I do mean unique, not in the sense of the word meaning rare. The word means one of a kind, not rare. He is truly one of a kind in that he only has one wife. There's no mention ever of him having any other wives or porcupines. He is just pretty much devoted to her. So that's kind of an unusual sort of situation. Then we have our friend Bethuel and his wife, who is nephew to Abraham. He is an Aramean, we are told. What does that mean? Arameans are people that are either ethnic or geographic or wanderers. They could be any of the three. Ethnic, there are people who are the offspring of someone from a guy by the name of Aram. That means Aramean. Or they could have lived in an area. Haran was that area. Or they could have wandered about, because that's kind of Joseph. Jacob is talked about as being a wandering Aramean. And this idea of living a nomadic lifestyle is a common theme throughout Genesis. That even though they're prospering and doing very well, they don't really have that landedness yet. That hasn't fully come into being, and these folks are pretty nomadic. So there you have that particular perspective on this. And who are these young women that ride along with Rebecca? Are they friends? Are they her servants? Are they girls of marriageable age and hoping that there's more at home, just like Isaac with all the good stuff? So there you have it. Okay, we'll stop there. We're not stopping for the night. I'm just going to stop and ask, does anybody have any questions about this particular episode here?
Why was it a nurse and not a servant or a maiden, a handmaiden? Why is it any specific?
A nurse. You know, there are a couple places where it says nurse. That's probably more of an English affectation than it is a Hebrew one. Why I like the English Standard Version is because it's in the Tyndale tradition, and Tyndale wrote at the beginning of the 16th century, which is 500 years ago now, almost 500 years ago. And the English language has changed dramatically then, since then, and a nurse might have had a different connotation at that time. I don't know the Hebrew word off the top of my head, but exactly. Right.
Well, Mom has 12 other kids. Maybe you.
What's the word? Chaperone probably would be a better word to make sure things are done in an proper way. Chaperone might be a better word. Yes. So the question was, who was this lady? Okay, yes.
I was just thinking how long it would take to water 10 camels.
How long would it take to water 10 camels? You know that if you've watched the Popeye cartoon, it would take, you know, who knows, you'd sort of get at the end and kind of kick him and put his hand up, a tail up in there, and you kind of pump it in. That's kind of how if you watched the Popeye cartoon. But yeah, how long would it take to water 10 camels? That might take a while. You're right. Good question. Any other observations about what went on here? Yes, Keith.
I noticed that the servant always refers to God as the God of his master.
The God of his masters, yes. The servant always refers to the Lord as, well, first of all, he always refers to him as the Lord, which is the proper name, because you remember you see the L-O-R-D in small caps like that. That's the holy name of God, which the Jews didn't say out loud, and it didn't have anything to it had more to the fact to do with it. They didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain rather than it being so sacred that they couldn't say it. But you remember, if indeed the servant is Eleazar of Damascus, he would have likely had a different religious upbringing than Abraham would have. So that's why. But it's a good observation. Yes, very good observation. Other things.
Did Sarah die because it was a punishment because of her scheming before?
She was old.
Yeah, but she never got, Abraham got to see Isaac get married. But
I don't know. I think it's probably, I mean, again, there's no biblical warrant for that. I mean, there's nothing that connects those dots. Maybe in a Gothic Christian romance novel, you might find something like that. I don't know. I've come up with a good plot for one, by the way. I'm well, of course, then again, we have this new movie out, Young Messiah, which, of course, is simply a pure novel. Young Messiah. Young Messiah. So no, the answer is there is no biblical warrant to suggest that. That she's just 130 some odd years old and, you know, I'm done. Of course, Abraham lives to be 175. And as we see, the superannuation is starting to decrease. Except Isaac lives to be, this is the funny thing. To me, this is just hilarious. Everybody, you know where we're going with all this. We're going to the great little episode of Isaac and the Jacob, not Isaac and Jacob, Isaac, Jacob, Rebecca, and Esau, and the whole issue of the birthright. That's where we're all leading up to. We all know that story. Well, how do I say this? We'll just get that when we get there. We'll get that. Okay? Other observations? Yes?
So, Abraham's servant is very specific when he's asking for
yes.
boxes to check. Is that how we should pray also?
I don't know why not. I mean, here's what I would do in this regard. I would ask God, what boxes do you want checked? That's how I would say, are there certain boxes that you want checked? Sometimes he checks them for us. Let me give you an example of some of the check boxes for me at my last congregation. One was... I hate saying this even. It's just so bothersome. Oh, gosh. You know, every pastor needs a prophet to speak into his life or her life. The problem that I have is the prophet who speaks into my life happens to be my mother-in-law. It's just so annoying when she's right. It's just so annoying. She is the most overly cheery person on the planet. Now, I'm not a down kind of guy. I'm an enthusiastic kind of guy. But she is just, She's cloyingly sweet. I mean, it's like saccharin. I mean, it's just spiritual saccharin. I am unemployed because I knew that God had called me away from the place I had been and told me, he says, Paul, you know, you're to quit without a call. You know, you don't just put it behind you and then try these other things. And I'm getting, I'm second in call process after call process after call process. And humanly speaking, I'm looking at I shouldn't say such things about my colleagues in ministry. I was going to call them yo-yos, but I shouldn't do that. And I'm saying, why? And then my mother-in-law, on the day I get two many fine candidates letters, by the way, that's what the call committee sends out to the people who don't get, says, many fine candidates apply, and you're one of them, but, you know, but I got two many fine candidates, and my mother-in-law calls me, and she says, Paul, the Lord told me, when I hear that, I just like, the Lord told me that on your birthday, he's going to do something about your call. Yeah, I needed to hear that day, oh yeah. And my birthday's in 5 days. On my birthday, I get a letter from Faith Lutheran Church in Seguin, Texas, that says, Dear Pastor Cross, it was from First Lutheran in New Braunfels, a place that I had gotten a many fine candidates letter from. Said, you were a really great candidate and we thought very highly of you. We know of a church that we think would work really well for you and you should consider applying. And that letter was postmarked. Now, my birthday is June 24th. She told me 5 days earlier, so it was June 20th. It was postmarked June 14th. Now, I got to tell you something. It does not take 10 days for a letter to get from Seguin to Savage, Minnesota. It doesn't take that long. I've sent many of them. It might take three at the tops. Between there and somehow that letter arrived on my birthday. I was so mad, I did not respond for a month. I did not respond for a month. And I just said, I'm not going to, no. And then when I responded, it was like, boom. So it was kind of funny. That was just one of the checkboxes. The fact that it was from Seguin, Texas. I lived in Seguin. Not only did I know where Seguin was, I knew how to pronounce it. I mean, if you see the word Seguin, you are going to say Sequin, because that's just what your eyes will tell you it is, but that's, or say something else. So, I mean, it was like that. The only relative I've ever had as a pastor, it was a second cousin once removed. That's pretty remote, wouldn't you say? Was an assistant pastor at Faith Lutheran in Seguin. And my pastor growing up, he was the associate pastor, but he was kind of my pastor, Rick Doss. Faith Lutheran was his home church. And that was in Vienna, Virginia, where he was my pastor growing up. So it's kind of funny. So that would be the boxes being checked, okay? That would be an example of that. Now, I didn't pray for any of that. As a matter of fact, I was rebuking some of it, as I said. I was just, I don't, but it be that as it may. So, yeah, I would say, God, show me the check boxes. Show me the things that you want me to be confident about. I don't think it's wrong to pray for fleece. You know, that's the phrase from the book of Judges where Gideon gets a little overboard about this business, and he gets a lot overboard, actually. But I don't think it's wrong to say, God. But the thing then, see, when you ask that, here's the problem. Then you got to listen. And see, that's the thing we don't want to do. We don't want to wait, because we hate waiting to listen. I was just being ornery, and just an ornery cuss, and said, I'm not going to do this. You can't make me. So I just hurt myself for a month, that's all. Could have been there a month sooner, earning money. I mean, so there you go. All right? Well, I guess we had enough ratchet jawing. But God bless you. Go into the highways and the byways. Compel your friends to come, because we're back having more fun than the law allows. And who knows, they may come upon the time when we come across Jacob asking his son Joseph to swear and make an oath. And that'll be fun to see them cringe, just like you cringed when I said what it was. Anyway, anybody feel like praying? Or do I have to do this? Or do I get to do this? Anybody want to pray? Please, somebody. Pick somebody, I'll pick you, Megan.
Okay.
Amen. Excellent job. Go eat pizza and serve the Lord. Thank you.